I always talk about rewatchability. If afterwards I say to myself, would I want to go see this movie? Virtuoso filmmaking by Scorsese. It's some of the best work he's done.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
Still riding the high of Robert De Niro last week. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know if this qualifies as rank self-absorption or just pride, but I've listened to the interview now three times since it actually aired on Cinephile. I'm just trying to get the numbers up, but I'm like, the thing that hits me every time is when I hear my voice asking a question and then Robert De Niro is actually answering the question. I just can't get over that, Stancic. My thanks to all those that have tweeted the show, and particularly getting pub out for Cinephile, that episode alone. Scott Van Pelt, Mike Greenberg, Mike Golick Jr., Ryan Russillo, Danny Cannell, all my baseball buddies, Buster, Timmy, Stark, Keith Law, did a tremendous job of getting the word out. And people have definitely, people who had not heard of Cinephile before were like, hey, you got De Niro? I've got to listen to this. So my thanks to all those that listened and have been so kind and offering such kind words. I think the other big takeaway is people are still shocked that Stancic didn't want to get a picture with him, but would do so with one of a female, like Mila
Kunis.
Don't
lie. No one said that.
That's really like, oh, yeah, I still can't believe Stancic wouldn't get a picture. Now, the thing that people actually really enjoyed was, sadly, maybe, the postscript they find more entertaining even than the interview. They're like, the interview was good. It was very professionally proficient, and you did a good balance of being a journalist but also being a bit of a fanboy. Like, he clearly could get that you're a fan. But they go, the backstory behind it, the stress and the anxiety and the stories, like, that kind of brings the story full circle.
The driving 5 hours to do the interview and then 5 hours back to Pennsylvania, I think, speaks for itself. You also brought in a figurine of one of his characters and showed it to him. He's this 70-something-year-old male, and he's like, what is this guy doing to me?
I wish we don't have any video, right? Like, at no point were we shooting video of it. It's only still pictures.
We have three pictures, all on my phone. I think I sent them all to you. I don't know what else you want.
I just wish we had video. I could just roll it in my room and just consistent, like on a projector. Here I am interviewing De Niro again, the height of self-absorption. You're right, the figurine, it didn't. I listened back to that break. I goes, oh, okay, yeah. Like, wow, weird is this guy? You thought Travis Bickle was a nut. My goal, of course, is not only to spread the word about Cinephile and to hopefully share this love of movies that I have with everybody, but also to educate. And that starts with my buddy Stancic. Major news. He finally saw The Verdict, which I'm so happy he did. What did you think?
I'll tell you what. Had you not hyped it up that much, I don't think I would have gotten the ending as being that transfixing.
Right.
I think it was just like, oh, you know, it's over. I won the case. But while you bring up movies that I've now seen, I have now seen Quick Change.
Yes! Yes!
And Rushmore.
Yes!
And your top five of Bill Murray movies is now even more appalling to me.
No, listen.
Because his roles in those movies is not nearly as good as his roles in other films that you neglected in your top five. Appalling.
Rushmore first. Scorsese loved it so much, he wrote Wes Anderson a handwritten note going, that's one of the best movies I've seen in a long time.
It's a great movie, but his role in it is subpar compared to his other roles.
No,
he's a relatively minor character.
No, he's not. He's critical.
The movie is about the kid. It is not about Bill Murray.
She's my Rushmore. That's what makes it good. How about
he has like one or two decent lines. Okay.
The revenge
Quick Change
fantasy
is actually better. His role in Quick Change is better than his role in Rushmore.
First
Quick
on
Change
Rushmore.
Is a horrible movie.
No. The revenge fantasy sequence is great in Rushmore, where they're going back and forth. And also the scene, he just swats the ball away from the kid playing basketball. How about the scene where he yells at his kids, put their seatbelts on? But Quick Change. Not only Bill Murray's, how about just the clown sequence, the whole sequence at the beginning? Is this a local call? Dial 212. All right, clown, enough out of you.
It is clever, but like it didn't really hold up. I don't know.
All right.
He's in so many better movies.
Still appalled.
Appalling.
Also, this week for Scorsese Stories, Stancic finally saw Mean Streets. So rather than – I'll tell more stories about Mean Streets, but I want to hear Stancic's review of Mean Streets. That's what we're going to do. All right, Terry Crews is coming up. He's unbelievable. I met him at the celebrity softball game in San Diego. He's so funny. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a hysterical show. He's going to tell you stories about that, but also The Expendables. What was it like working with all the great action heroes of our time and how they would muscle up with each other? And Terry gets very candid about his pornography addiction, how he overcame that, why he went public with that. So that interview is coming up next. But first, reviews of new movies. So first and foremost, went and saw Sully. I was a little bit hesitant because I'm like, what exactly is the whole goal here? Like, the story is still so fresh. I'm well aware of what this gentleman did and how heroic it was and the miracle on the Hudson and saving 155 passengers by landing his plane in the river. So why are we making a true life movie about it? And I guess the answer is, you know, we make a true life movie about everything. So I'm like, all right, fine. But I got to be honest with you, first and foremost, it's a disappointment. Because if you're going to take a story like this, you have to somehow make what is already extraordinary in real life and then supersede it in fiction, which is already sounds like an impossible task. So how do you make something which already has a huge amount of resonance for people make it even special? You have to have new information, new material that you don't know about the story, or you just tell it in such a visceral, captivating fashion that it overwhelms the senses, which it did not do. So I thought it was, you know, Eastwood's direction was very uninspired. It was very paint by numbers. The first 30 minutes is just jarringly boring because, like, I wasn't sure if it was going to be here's Sully growing up, here's how he became a pilot. Okay, second act is the actual landing, and then the third act is the aftermath. Instead, and I give them credit, they tried to be different about it. They started so-called present day, so it was after the miracle was happening. But literally, it's 30 minutes of boardroom meetings, and he couldn't have directed it more stale. It's just establishing shot, two-shot, reaction shot. Like, who the hell wants to watch a movie with a bunch of board meetings? Like, essentially, the movie becomes a cross-examination of Sully and whether or not he did the right thing. And I guess this is the material that they're hoping would be interesting, is if you don't know the story, he got a lot of heat from the airlines with the fact that they believed, even with the engine going down, even after the birds went in there, he had enough time to land back at LaGuardia. So essentially, it wasn't like he was going to get sued, but it was like he was culpable in that he took a risk that wasn't necessary. He could have just landed back at LaGuardia. The birds, you know, hitting the engine happened quickly after takeoff. He unnecessarily took this gigantic risk going in the river. And that's how they try to hold the suspense for the movie, but it just doesn't hold its weight. Thankfully, the sequence where the plane actually does do the landing is well done. But again, it's done in flashbacks, so it's not like it's one big continuous shot. Like, think about The Aviator. When Howard Hughes goes down, like, Scorsese puts all the razzle-dazzle in there. Like, you've got to have a great big plane crash that people are going to remember. Flight, your boy Denzel. By the way, we're doing Denzel Actors Showcase coming up today. I thought it was a good movie. I didn't think it was great. I didn't like the ending, the way he admits that he's an alcoholic, like, in that final scene. I didn't think he would do that in that vein. But I thought he was great in the movie, and that crash is extraordinary. Like, Zemeckis knows, I've got to make this look as powerful as it can be. Like, I need to entrance the audience. Like, you have to be visually dazzling in these moments. If Eastwood doesn't pull it off when you're going to see a movie called Sully, then it's a disappointment, plain and simple. It's shorter than I thought, which is good news. It's 96 minutes, but I'm telling you, the first 30 minutes is so drab and slow pace, you're going to have a tough time trying to get through it. Maybe you figure, okay, it's not just going to be about Sully. Maybe he'll tell, like, some backstories about the passengers, 155 people there, maybe the flight crew, maybe the co-pilot played by Aaron Eckhart. No, there's no backstories of any of these people. It's just faceless people who are being evacuated at some point, so there's no real human interest story there. It's not like a disaster movie like Alive where you start to learn about the characters and where they came from and why this is important. He really doesn't, you know, he eschews that material. And as for Hanks's performance, he's fine, but I mean, it is as predictable a Tom Hanks performance as you'll ever imagine. Just heroic and stoic and just a good dude and trying to do the right thing. And again, to go back to Flight, if you're going to have a disaster movie, you know, you have to have, this is the biggest flaw of Sully. You have to have a captivating central character. Plain and simple. Denzel in Flight is captivating because he's a hero, but he's also a drunk who took a bunch of drugs and they killed some people on the plane, but he saved most of them. But that's what makes human drama compelling, that there has to be some warts within it. Sully is a completely bland character. There's nothing interesting about this guy. He's a good family man. He did the right thing by landing, and that's it. He doesn't have a drinking problem, doesn't have a drug problem, isn't a sex addict. He doesn't have an issue with his children. He's a good husband. Like, there's nothing unique. He doesn't have a bad temper. Like, there's nothing unique about this guy. He's just a bland, predictable person. Hanks plays him exactly as he is, which is a straight arrow, which is fine for real life. But in a movie, you got to give me some substance here. So I'm giving Sully two maple leaves. It's, you know, people today like to call it old-fashioned entertainment, which just means, you know what? It's awfully square and it's awfully bland. And that's where I'm coming up with Sully. You going to go see it, Stancic, or no?
Not after that.
Yeah.
Man, I know you're a Hanks hater, so I got to back that in a little bit.
That's not true.
But it sounds like a bad spinoff of Flight.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Which was not a good Denzel movie.
Right, but I'm telling you, Flight compared to this is like Ben-Hur. It was outstanding. The next movie, though, and I understand we do a lot of dramas and heavy-handed movies. Well, it's time for some comedies. This is the funniest movie of the year. And it's not Sausage Party, because I reviewed that previously. I gave it 2.5. It's called Pop Star, Never Stop Popping, starring our boy Andy Samberg. Now, I am not an SNL guy. I haven't watched Saturday Night Live in about, I'm going to say, 15, 20 years. Like, my heyday was Phil Hartman and Mike Myers and Adam Sandler, those guys. This movie is hysterical. And, like, I'm saying this as a guy who doesn't know Sandberg's work. Like, I've seen Brooklyn Nine-Nine a few times. I'm aware of the skits with Justin Timberlake. But I don't go, oh, Andy Samberg, I'm in on this. I just go, okay, I'm aware of his stuff. from now on, though, I'm all in on Andy Samberg because of this movie, because it's basically just an elaborate spoof of Justin Bieber. But it calls to mind one of the great comedies of all time, which is This is Spinal Tap, the Rob Reiner movie and Christopher Guest. And that is such a landmark movie. And they definitely borrow from that and having these really funny songs and being so satirical. There's a song like early on in the gate, like Samberg comes to prominence, and it's like a gay anthem. And his refrain is, "I'm not gay." So like the whole song, he's singing like, "Hey, if you were gay," he's like, "I'm not gay. I'm not gay. Hey, I'm not gay." And like, he's trying to be pro gay. And yet he's so sensitive to gay rights and him being gay. He's like, "Hey, I'm not gay. I'm not gay. I'm not gay. Not gay." And at one point they have Ringo Starr doing a cameo. He goes, "Why is he singing a song about not being gay and gay rights? It's already allowed. Like, why is he doing this?" And they've got, I mean, you talk about star studded cameos. They've got everybody. Like Justin Timberlake plays a chef in there. Mariah Carey's in the movie. I mean, all these SNL alum. And the guy that steals the movie, our boy Will Arnett, who is doing a Harvey Levin send-up. He's only in like two scenes. I sent Will a message. I go, "Dude, I've watched your scenes like 10 times each. It is so funny what he's doing with Harvey Levin and that whole TMZ crew. The way it's shot, like, it is a perfect send-up of what... how stupid that whole TMZ show is. Will Arnett is Harvey Levin. Like, in a just world, that he would be winning awards for this. He's only in it like 10 minutes, but it's amazing how funny Will Arnett is. Another song, I can't really say on the podcast, but Andy Samberg says that a girl is imploring him to do to him, to do to her what the U.S. government did to Bin Laden. It is such a filthy song, and he's singing it like in this huge concert. These teenage girls are going crazy, but it's so infectious. I mean, it actually is a really catchy pop song. I'm like, if they played this Bin Laden song on the air, it would actually sell records. That's how catchy it is. Good news is it's pretty short. It's like 85 minutes, and it's a laugh riot start to finish. I'm giving it 3.5 Maple Leafs. You want to have a really good laugh, you go watch Popstar, Never Stop Popping, which is currently available on DVD and DirecTV. The next movie is Hell or High Water. This is a Southern crime film, which I really enjoyed. I was hearing rave reviews about it. I believe on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got like 98%. So it's the best-reviewed movie of the year so far. Jeff Bridges stars as a sheriff who's going after a couple of robbers. And it really calls to mind a great underrated B-movie called One False Move, which came out in 1991. And it was... starring a young Billy Bob Thornton, and Bill Paxton's in it. Carl Franklin is the director. It's one of those great, under-the-radar action movies that you never really hear about unless someone tells you about it, and you go watching it. Wow, this One False Move is really good. But really, this movie, Hell or High Water, nails the idea of the South and the way these guys are, and not only with the music and the costumes, but just that whole vibe of Southern culture. But rather than being romanticized about it, or, you know, a bunch of farmers here, these guys are looking to get some money. And there are a couple of rednecks who just want to rob some banks and make some money. And Chris Pine and Ben Foster are the two guys that are the robbers. And I've never seen either play this kind of role. Ben Foster's a pretty good actor. He's kind of under the radar. And Chris Pine, of course, you know from Star Trek. But here he's got the big old stash. They got their cowboy shirts, their cowboy hats, their boots. And they do an excellent job of playing these young guns. And then Bridges is like channeling Sam Elliott in The Big Lebowski. Like, Bridges' best role is the dude in The Big Lebowski. And here he's kind of like Sam Elliott. He just has the huge mustache and the big cowboy hat. And it's just a really well-paced thriller. Like, you're going to get your gunplay and your bank heist scenes. But it's further demonstration of why Jeff Bridges is one of the best actors out there. Like, he's so good at playing this kind of character. So check out Hell or High Water. I'm giving this one 3.5 Maple Leafs. Shades of One False Move, that B-movie. If you want some a little more mainstream, I guess it's a little bit like No Country for Old Men. So if you like No Country for Old Men, I definitely think you'll appreciate Hell or High Water. The next movie that I'm reviewing is Maggie's Plan. This is with my guy Ethan Hawke. We're going romantic comedy here, mixing it up. This definitely has shades of Woody Allen. Rebecca Miller is the writer-director. She's actually the wife of Daniel Day-Lewis, who's one of my favorite actors. And the story is very whimsical, and it's about this girl named Greta Gerwig is the actress. And she falls in love with Ethan Hawke, who's actually married to Julianne Moore. She, you know, Hawke's on the downside of his marriage, so ends up having an affair with her. He leaves his wife, who's Julianne Moore, for Greta Gerwig. The plan then fast forwards, and the reason why the movie's called Maggie's Plan is her idea is to now put Ethan Hawke and Julianne Moore back together, because she's realized that, you know, marrying him is a mistake. Their marriage has not worked out, even though she was hoping it would. He's basically just a self-absorbed guy who's just a big lout and doesn't care about her. and she tries to get them back together. So I thought the concept was cute. Again, romantic comedies are not something that not a genre that I particularly have a fondness for. But I thought if you like that type of movie, then I thought Maggie's Plan was really endearing because of the performances of the leads, Ethan Hawke, Julianne Moore, and Greta Gerwig, who has this real kind of, I don't want to say Annie Hall type quality to her, but she definitely has that bubbliness of a young Diane Keaton in those Woody Allen movies. And I think the movie very obviously is cribbing from Woody Allen and those early films that he made. But it's really sweet, and I think in that vein, I'm giving that movie 3 Maple Leafs. How about a documentary? We're all over the place. We got romantic comedies, we got Southern crime dramas, we have straight up comedies, and we have the real life tale with Sully. How about a documentary, Wiener, which is about Anthony Wiener, the disgraced politician? This one, unfortunately, feels a little bit dated only because of recent events. Because what happened just a couple weeks ago, there was another sexting scandal involving this guy. So if you try to, when I watched it, I tried to forget about that had just happened, which is an impossibility, but bear with me. You watch it because what it's doing is it's showing from when the first scandal had already hit and he's trying to redeem himself now and he was running for New York City mayor. So the movie does an excellent job. Stanzik's are my political savant here, so he knows all about Anthony Wiener. But I didn't know as much about him. Like, he was this Democratic congressman who was great. Like, they start the movie the first 10 minutes of, like, all the times he was so impassioned. And he would, like, just yell down the Speaker of the House or anybody opposing him, and really is kind of like an old school, like a Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Like, I'm going to fight for the little guy. I'm going to fight for the middle class. And he seemed genuine about it. So just seeing his politics, I'm like, oh, I can see why this guy was so powerful and the fact that he was so charismatic. Then they explain the sexting scandal, how that went down. But now he's trying to regroup. He's trying to run for mayor. So the movie's kind of shown behind the scenes. How does politics work? Okay, it's fine. But then the second scandal hits. So now it's like, oh, my God. So now this documentary goes from what feels like a rehab project for Anthony Wiener to now, no, how does a political candidate deal with crisis again the second time? And it's not really dramatic because you really feel for Huma, his wife, because you're like, I can't believe that she's with this guy. And she's in the documentary. Like, you know, they see her talking to him and stuff. But there's never a scene where she tells the camera, here's why I stayed with him or here's why I still love him. Like, it's not that open-ended. But you see their interactions and you see them saying, how are we going to deal with this now? What are we going to say to the papers? What are we going to do? And Huma was so selfless. She came out and said, listen, my husband had a problem. You know, this second sexting scandal, which feels new to all of you, is actually old news. Like, before we were going to separate, so this is not new to me, what's happened, what Anthony was doing. This is old news here. We're just moving forward. I think he'll be a great mayor, and let's just try to do this. And what's crazy about the documentary is that he doesn't really acknowledge that he has a problem. Like, whenever they kind of mention it, it's always like, all right, how do we fix this? Like, how do we troubleshoot this? It's not, I have a problem. I should go to rehab. Like, why do I keep doing this? He's not introspective, which in a way I think shows how successful he's been, because he's just so stubborn and logical. Like, let's just push ahead. I'm going to be mayor. Focus on the issues. I'm going to help the middle class. I want no more tax cuts for the rich. It's going to be, forget about all that. They aren't going to listen to you because of all your personal life, unless you acknowledge your personal life. And so he gets interviewed. Okay, we have to do the interviews with the late night shows or whatever. Fine. But he's so combative about it. Like, he goes on with CNN and they just want to ask him, Anthony, what are you doing? Like, well, there's going to be questions about your character. How do you answer those? It's like, you know what? I've already talked about it. It's happened in the past. Let's focus on the issues. Let's focus on fiscal responsibility. Let's focus on job creation. And it's like, you don't get it. People want to know what's other stuff. At one point in the New York mayor election, he was leading. They're like, his numbers are great. Then once that second scandal hit, it was like, psh, game over, done. They're like, this guy did this once before. Now he's done it again. No chance. And there's an amazing scene. He goes and it's like a Jewish area of New York City, and the guy just starts attacking him. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I see Stanzik's nodding. He remembers this. I've never seen this video. It's unbelievable the way the guy starts going at him. And Wiener should just walk away. Like, forget it, man. But he's like, because the guy's, you know, he's obviously admonishing him. Like, what kind of a father are you? What kind of a husband are you? And he's like, you know what, buddy? Like, yeah, like, you don't have flaws, man. Yeah, like, you don't have flaws. Hey, I'll go into your personal house. And it's like, Wiener, dude, like, you don't have to fight everybody. Like, that combativeness in government is important. But on a personal scale, walk away. There's cameras here. Everybody's watching it. You look like a doofus. You look like this hot-tempered heel. And, like, the guys, he brings up the fact he's Jewish. He's like, oh, don't you know my friend? Like, you got a yarmulke on. Don't you know our faith, what our faith's about? Like, you know, you shouldn't be judging others. Only one guy can judge me. That's the Lord. Like, it's just ugly the whole time. You go, doesn't he have the self and arrows to walk away? The events are the great clip of Jon Stewart. Because the one thing that the movie does try to show is sympathy for Wiener, because they keep interspersing Fallon and Leno and Letterman. Like, these guys, it was a nightly punchline. Like, it was the gift that kept on giving, Anthony Wiener jokes. And they show Jon Stewart's show the scale. And at one point, I guess the Jewish guy had muttered to Wiener, yeah, and you're married to an Arab too. And Jon Stewart goes, that guy really said that? Hey, you know what? F that guy. he's supporting Wiener because of how bad it was.
That John Stewart and Anthony Wiener were like friends on the Jersey Shore.
Really? They didn't mention
not
that.
Not necessarily like grew up together, but like early out of college were friends. I think may have even lived in the same summer house together.
Oh, wow.
So there was a friendship there. It was very odd. And when that was all going on, the first scandal, that's when Stewart was filming his movie. So that was when John Oliver was in for Stewart on The Daily Show.
Oh, wow.
And he was crushing Wiener.
Yeah, like the way that they assaulted this guy, like even I'm watching it going, okay, listen, he has flaws. We all have personal feelings. This guy's getting roasted every day. The newspaper, the New York Post tabloids, like everything's about this. Like, I'm like, I can't believe he's still even in the public eye. So at one point, it's amazing. Like when he realizes, like, he just gets roasted and he has no chance of winning the election. And he's completely on the edge of ruin. The documentarian even says to him, like, why did you let me film you? Like, why did you agree to this? Like, you know what you are. You know what you've done. Why the hell would you give me access to document this complete crumbling of a human being in his political campaign? If you love politics like Stanzik, it's a must. If you just like good documentaries, it's a must. And I think it's a really enjoyable movie. I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs, so check out Wiener for a good documentary there. So to recap, Sully gets 2 Maple Leafs. Pop Star Never Stop Poppin' gets 3.5 Maple Leafs. Maggie's Plan gets 3 Maple Leafs. What else did I say? Wiener gets 3.
Hell or High Water.
And Hell or High Water, Southern crime drama. You'll definitely be hearing about that one. 3.5 Maple Leafs as well. Great to have my man Terry Crews here with us on Cinephile. First and foremost, Terry, why are you still clothed? I was expecting you to be having your shirt off immediately.
Oh, no, it was coming off on the way over, and I said, maybe I'll do it a little bit later.
All right, we were hoping for our first shirtless guest here on Cinephile.
Well, I realized you couldn't see it, so I said,
That's a very good point. Speaking of, the last time I hung out with my man T. Crews was at Celebrity Softball in San Diego, and the moment that everybody is still talking about is this. Now, you were obviously playing in it. I'm assuming you didn't DVR it, but this was my call of what happened.
David Wells making him wait. Oh, my.
He got foul tip.
He struck him out. Hang on a second. Is that a foul tip? He got him. Terry Crews just struck out with his shirt off. He looked so good with the shirt off, and then he looked terrible when he had to swing the bat. Come on, TC, what happened?
Really?
What happened? That is a humbling moment for Terry Crews.
Oh, yay. So the thing everybody keeps saying to me is, like, the fact that I was screaming, he looked so good when he took his shirt off, and then what happened when he struck out? Now, my belief is this. I'm telling everybody.
Okay.
I go, Terry is funny. He's a goofball. He totally struck out on purpose. Right?
No.
No, you're lying to me.
Bro.
You're lying right now.
I went for
you're
it.
You're an athlete. You're an NFL player for years. There's no way you
struck
out.
No, man. First of all, I'm an athlete, too. I'm an athlete, but that doesn't mean I can go drive a, Indy 500 car, I have no idea. Baseball is a skill, man.
You're right.
It's a skill. Dude, I knew I wasn't going to hit that ball. I knew it. So I said, you know what? How can I? Because imagine what would happen if I just whiffed it and left. No. I said, I got to make this a show. The people paid their money, and I'm going to give them something to see. And let me tell you something. They did it. And it worked. When that clip is still playing right
now. There's no question.
Drew Brees hit a home run. Drew Brees hit a home run. You see that clip?
No
one sees that clip.
Like, our producer after goes, guess what went viral? Terry taking his shirt off, the peck dance, and when he struck out. Well, that's all anybody's talking about.
You got to understand.
Nina Agdal. That's Leo's girlfriend. Nobody cares. Terry Crews struck out.
You know what was wild is that I got all these people that were online like, you suck. And you can't. It's a shame of it all. Shame of it all. But the deal is I am unembarrassable. That's a superpower I have. You can't embarrass me. It's not. And you know what? The good thing was, is that I'm also telling people, go for it. Just go for it.
Yeah.
Who cares?
That's a great point.
You know what? Life is, if you know you're not going to hit it, just go for it. Just try it. And if I would have hit it, it'd been fine, but it didn't.
My belief is Terry Crews was on the take. J.K. Simmons gave him some money to strike out just so J.K. would look all right. That is absolutely what I think happened. You actors funny. All stick together. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is coming out next week. Hysterical show. You are great on it.
Thank you.
Andy Samberg is great on it. The guy I want to ask you about, though, is Andre Brower, because I loved Homicide, Life on the Street, which was a great cop drama, and he actually won an Emmy the final season of that show. But on your show, again, he's playing a cop, but he's a sergeant who's gay, and it's all kind of very straight-laced. Tell me about working with Andre.
Andre legitimizes our show. Legitimizes. I mean, you're talking about a guy, Juilliard trained, a superstar, Emmy Award winning, guy who played a detective police officer for years
right.
on a legitimate, serious, hardcore show called Homicide, and then it flips into the craziest comedy. That, again, you got to understand that, that Andre was in Glory with Denzel Washington,
yes.
Morgan Freeman. He's of that class.
Right.
And to come on our show and to do the things he does, like dress up like a penguin, and I mean, not penguin, a pigeon, or, you know, just put himself in these positions where you just go, oh, my God, I can't believe we have the Andre Brower doing it. Right. You almost have to ask yourself, am I watching this?
Right.
Am I really watching it? And the lines he gets to say, he is amazing. He legitimizes what we do, and then we can be as funny as possible.
The greatness of Brooklyn Nine-Nine and why you guys should be so proud is that in today's television, it's a lot easier. The critics are all focusing on these shows that are not on network television. So
right.
Game of Thrones gets love,
yeah.
and Veep gets love, and all these shows. And I'm like, what you guys are doing is a very classic sitcom, which today I think is incredibly difficult because of that competition you're facing from those other networks.
Well, it is. I mean, I think we give you comedy for a new age. You know what I mean? There's no laugh track. There's right. no single camera thing. We're not all on stages and doing right. It feels like you know us. And I have to say, though, the reason why Brooklyn Nine-Nine works is because it's diversity. It's the way we look. We mm-hmm. look like people you know.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you look at TV just 10 years ago, it was kind of crazy. I mean,
Seinfeld and Friends were in New York. You never saw a person of color on that show.
What New York is that? I mean, you have to say, there were a lot of people who loved the show. But
sure, okay.
I was one of those guys who was like, man,
yeah.
no black people in New York. No, Hispanics
no brown people in
New York.
Come on.
And I was like, come on. And it's kind of wild. But see, with us,
right.
here you have two African-American men who run the precinct.
Mm-hmm.
You have two Latina women who are great at what they do. Mm-hmm. You have a crazy, Jake Peralta played by Andy Samberg. You mm-hmm. got Joe Latrulio. You got Chelsea Peretti doing her thing. It feels like a real life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I think is really the difference that puts us above all the other stuff. It's like, man, I know these guys. I work there. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Totally.
I know. I feel like I've worked with these guys my whole life, and I've never been an officer. I've never been around them, but it's so familiar, and I think that's why it works.
The show is hysterical. You can see it on Fox. The season premiere is starting next week. My wife said you were the nicest of all the celebrities in San Diego. She goes, Terry Crews is great. You have to get him on the show. He was such a sweet guy. I said, yeah. I said, well, you know why? She goes, why? She goes, he was in White Chicks, which is one of her favorite movies. And this was her question. She goes, you have to ask, because I go, everybody tells him to sing the Vanessa Carlton song.
So that's
played out. She said the funniest scene is at the end when Wayans takes the mask off. It's not that you say you're a man. It's that you're not black.
No, I said you're not white.
You're not white.
That's it. Well, let me tell you something. And this is weird. I will tell a little secret here.
Sure.
The character I played was actually based on a real ball player that I knew.
NFL player.
A real NFL ball player. And it was wild. I mean, this guy, he was like, he had his focus on one kind of person.
Right.
One kind of thing. And he was so, it was a mission for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of sad, to be honest with you. Like, it didn't matter, a beautiful black woman came over.
White chicks, baby.
Beautiful Indian woman. He was like, man, no, excuse me. Hello. And he'd go right over to that blonde. And it was like, it was beeline, you know. And it was funny, and this guy knows who he is, because I told him,
sure.
And it's so funny, because we always look at each other and laugh. I'm like, you know you helped my career, don't you? And he just laughs, but it's really, this is the reason why it was so funny, is because a lot of people, recognize
right,
that was a real deal.
Right.
It's very funny.
It's a great movie, and I also wonder how much you get talked about the Old Spice commercials.
Oh, yeah, man.
Does that get tiresome that people still bring it up?
Oh, no,
because it was a great campaign.
Wait, I'm not tired of anything anybody brings up
right.
on me. You know, it's so many people trying to run away from stuff. I'm trying to run back into stuff. You know what I'm saying? I'll go back and do Everybody Hates Chris again.
No, that was great. Doing. Yeah, you're
You know what I mean? I swear, I have never done a character that I didn't like doing. Because
awesome.
I don't do anything for money. I have never, ever acted for money, ever. Yeah. I have to feel it and love it, and I do it. You know what I'm saying?
It's right.
one of those, doing Newsroom was one of the most greatest experiences for me,
mm-hmm.
just like doing Idiocracy and playing President Camacho,
right.
or jumping over and doing Brooklyn Nine-Nine, or doing a movie with Ridiculous Six with Adam and all those guys.
Right.
Dude, I am living a dream. You know what I mean? This is stuff that you did when you were a kid. You played dress up, you played outside, you played cops and robbers, you did your thing. Right. And now I get to do it, and then they pay you for it. It's crazy.
That's great, man.
A good life.
Give me a story from The Expendables, all those big action
records. Oh, man, all those dudes. Everybody getting together. And the thing is, it got kind of funny because people wouldn't be at the weight room at the same time. Because no one wanted to give out their little secret, like that one little move.
Right.
That's all the difference. But I didn't care because I was in the gym the whole time. But I noticed that you would see like Van Damme walk in and then he kind of walk back out. Or, you know, and then
slides on the bench.
Yeah,
I'll come
slides
back
like, yeah, you know, you got that? Okay, I'll be right back in a minute. Don't worry about it. No, you don't have to get up. No, I got it. And you started to notice that these dudes didn't want to give away their secrets.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it was kind of wild, but that's that ego thing. That's that. It's the same thing in sports.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hollywood is just like the sports world in probably every aspect.
And one of the reasons you've made that transition. I do want to ask you one serious question.
Okay.
You got five kids, which is amazing. I know you love your family, and I give you credit for this because this was very courageous. When you came out and you said, listen, I've got a problem with pornography addiction. There's not a lot of dudes in your position who would do that and do that publicly. And I can't think of how many other fathers out there who said, you know what? I've got these same issues, and if Terry Crews is going to be so public about that, and he's a major actor, and people are going to ask him about that, then maybe I should seek help too. I just want to know, what was the moment that you said, you know what, this has crossed over into something else?
Oh, wow, when my wife was like, I'm out. Wow. When my wife was like, I'm done. And it hits you, man. See, This is the thing. It's like having the only way I can really describe it is an erroneous belief. Mm-hmm. It's like having bad code in your computer. You understand what I mean? Right. I believed I was more valuable than my wife and kids. That's where it starts. Okay. Then it goes into you watch pornography and it becomes this thing where, you know, you're the man, you deserve it, I can do this. It's, you know, I'm a guy.
It's macho culture.
Right. I'm a guy, so right. It's not a problem, you know. And then you expect her to just understand. You know what I mean? Like, you know, guys, we like other, you know, we're going to look at girls, we're going to look at whatever.
Right.
But the truth is, that's not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Well, how would you like it if your girl was out there getting money from somebody else? You understand what I mean? And right. These kind of deep, deep-seated beliefs really, really changed and corrupted me. And this is one thing I have to say about the sports world. The sports world in general has what I call the cult of masculinity. I was a part of it. I was a card-carrying member of it. You know what I mean? Where you felt like we're men, we do it, look at these cheerleaders, look at and this is where guys get in trouble because they feel they can take something that doesn't belong to them. They feel like they deserve this. I won the game. I deserve the pretty girl. Even if she doesn't want you, it becomes this kind of thing. And let me tell you something. My wife was like, I am out. I don't even know you anymore. And it, you know, and it hit me. I said, hold on. I have to change. Right. I have to change. Because there was a minute there, I thought it was her. And I'm like, you know what? I'll just go get a new girl.
Right.
Peace.
Again,
bye,
cult of masculinity. Entitlement. I'll get a divorce.
Hey, look, you know how many women want me? I'm good.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, I had a small thought that said, maybe it's me. Maybe it's me. And then all of a sudden, once you crack that egg, that thing breaks all over the place. And I was making eggs, man. It was scrambled all over the place. I had to go to rehab.
That's tough.
Let me tell you, when I went to rehab, because I knew I had a problem, and I said, and the first day in there, I was like, I'm out. I don't need this. Right. I'm not as bad as these guys.
Right.
But the problem is when you don't recognize your problem as your own, that's the first mistake. It's always somebody else.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, sports world, they can say this on the sports team. You can say, you can't blame the quarterback. You got to blame you. You got to take responsibility. How many times do you hear this stuff and you don't get it in your life?
Right.
It's the transition. Athletes have a big, big problem. With, you know, because I call it fake discipline. You have a coach telling you when to wake up, when to eat, when to go to sleep, when to do your thing. And this is why they have problems when they retire. And all of a sudden, you're on your own and you gain 500 pounds.
Right.
And you don't know what to do. You get in all this trouble. You understand? Because the discipline was never yours. I had no self-discipline. And I had to get it. And I got it. And then when I went on Facebook, my whole mission was to tell any – it was like I had to be that guy who broke that ice for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you feel like, hey, Terry Crews has got an issue, then maybe you can come forward and you can do your thing.
Yeah.
You know? And I had to help a lot. And let me tell you, the floodgates opened, man.
Right.
For my Facebook, it was crazy. I got hundreds of thousands. I'm not talking hundreds. Hundreds of thousands of right. people who said, I have this problem too.
Right. I give you much props for doing it, man, and for helping all those out there. And next year, Celebrity Softball in Miami.
Yes.
I'll expect you there.
Me and my son, that was our road trip. It was one of the best things I ever did.
Oh.
And I can't wait to go back. And I'm going to hit the ball this time.
I know you will. He's going deep. Brooklyn Nine-Nine next week on Fox.
Actors Showcase.
All right, so if you want to know one thing about Stanzik, Denzel Washington is his favorite actor. Is that fair to say, Stanzik?
Definitely used to be. It was him and Leo were 1 and 1A. And,
No, it's been a lean decade.
He's fallen a little bit from two, his perch.
Two guns is not strong, Denzel, shall we say. He is a great actor, though, and I echo Stanzik's sentiments that at his best, tough to get better than a great Denzel Washington performance. So we're going 5-4-3-2-1. Spoiler alert, The Preacher's Wife is not making the list. So when it comes to the best movies of Denzel Washington, you know, I think he has a really innate ability to find the essence of his character. And I think that especially early on, he was this firebrand, and that was part of the goal of what kind of made him so good, was that when Denzel was acting, you felt that righteous fury. And in that vein, the number five movie I'm giving him is The Hurricane. Because that movie, and I remember afterwards, there was a bit of a backlash against Norman Jewison's film, because some people said, well, Reuben Hurricane Carter isn't as saintly as the movie portrays him to be, and he's got his own skeletons in the closet. And it was a little bit annoying, to be honest, because, we all get that it's a true life story, but we should just focus on the film itself. And I get that sometimes movies take liberties and then it feels false, but ultimately I think it should be judged as a movie. And the way that Denzel plays this guy, I mean, he's just wrongly accused and trying to fight for his freedom. And how can you not appreciate a guy who's undergoing this struggle? And there's moments of raw power in that movie that are as good as Denzel's done. There's one scene he's bald, he's got the glasses, and he's grabbing the phone, he's tapping it against the glass. He's like, you get me out of this jail. Like, he's so frustrated at that point that he's like, just help me out here, because he's dealing with this horrific story of being wrongfully imprisoned. I mean, I can't imagine many worse fates for anybody than having to do that. So The Hurricane is my number five movie. Number four, I know Stanzik is desperate to get Inside Man in here. I did toy with getting Inside Man in. Let's go Inside Man. I was going to really upset you. I'll tell you afterwards what I was thinking about, but I'll go ahead and do it. Inside Man is number four. It's a great bank movie, heist movie. Clive Owen's in it. Him and Denzel matching wits together is good. Spike Lee, who's one of my favorite directors, but has also fallen in lean times, hasn't made a great movie in the last decade or so. Especially the way his early classics were. Inside Man was a bit of a comeback for Spike. I remember it was a huge box office hit. It was well received by critics. People liked it. Inside Man, just a good genre film. It was really well done as far as, you know, a good bank heist movie and what it accomplished. And in fact, they talked about making a sequel. I don't remember what happened with that. Inside Man 2, I don't think it would have washed.
Dude, if you get Denzel as a detective, like, how can you go wrong?
That's true.
And there's a clever plot. That's just a great movie.
All right. So we got number four is Inside Man. Number three, Courage Under Fire. So, you know, we got this Gulf War drama here. Meg Ryan. Meg Ryan's okay in the way, but Denzel, again, really anchors it because of the fact he's this guy who is dealing with the past and this terrible atrocity. And the way he deals with his guilt is excellent. Like, he's this character who's trying to overcome this episode, and they're flashing back to it, and I thought it was really well directed and really well crafted. And there's one scene in there that's as good as Denzel's done. It's after he's going home, and he's now kind of accepted what he's done, and the guilt has been released, and he wants to just go home to his family, and he's done beating himself up, and everything's happened with Lou Diamond Phillips and Matt Damon, really good supporting cast in that movie. And as he's walking up, and I'm pretty sure this was ad-libbed, I read this, there's a bike, like, on the front lawn, and Denzel just kind of picks up the bike and puts it back, and it is such a wonderful, subtle gesture of this family man who is now accepting the fact that I'm going to stop beating myself up over what happened in the war. I'm going to stop abusing alcohol. I'm going to go back to being a dad. I'm picking the bike up. I'm going to be a good family man again. It's a really excellent scene. It's right at the end there of Courage Under Fire, number three movie. Number two is Glory. He won an Oscar for this one. My boy Dan Aykroyd was nominated for Driving Miss Daisy, great Canadian comic actor, and they asked him about winning. He goes, listen, I just saw Denzel Washington in Glory. I have no chance of winning. And if you haven't seen Glory, stop what you're doing. Go back and watch it. It's amazing. It's Civil War drama. And Denzel plays a runaway slave who signs up to fight for the 54th Regiment, which was all black. And they were the ones fighting for the North and fighting for their freedom. And all the different characters kind of have good backstories. You know, Matthew Broderick is the leader of them. And he's this young white guy who's a little bit out of his element, but he's trying to be supportive of these guys. But he's also trying to be rigid. So he's in a tough spot. Cary Elwes is his right-hand man. He's friends with Thomas, who's played by Andre Brower, who's this really smart, educated black intellectual, which means that the guys like Denzel are like, oh, you're this, not quite an Uncle Tom, but they view him through a negative prism because they're like, oh, you talk so proper, you think you're so much better than the rest of us. So Brower's hearing it from both sides. Morgan Freeman is the authoritative figure that they all look forward to. Like, he's kind of like their uncle or their father figure. And then Denzel's the runaway slave who's just filled with so much anger and spit and fire and just angry at the world. And I think Morgan Freeman even says that one point. He's like, this guy's just angry at everything. And there's one scene that he runs away and they catch him. And so the army has to punish him. And so Broderick calls for like 1,000 lashes and they just beat the crap out of this guy. And when they rip off Denzel's shirt on his back, you see all the lashes and all the beatings that he's taken as the slave and as you know, what the slave masters have done to him. And Denzel, the way he stares at Matthew Broderick, like, he's just got so much rage in his heart. Like, I don't care what you guys do to me, the kind of pain that I've felt my life. And he's staring at him with all this fury, anger. And then just the one single tear comes down. Like, it's just, it's amazing what he does with that movie. And later on, there's a campfire scene, which is also excellent. You know, all the guys are kind of bonding before the big last battle. And Denzel talks about, you know, this is what the war's all about. This is why I'm with you guys. And even though he's been this hard ass the entire movie, he does have a soul and he does want to be with them. And the way that he shows the humanity beneath this gruff, tough exterior, glory's outstanding. Number one, Malcolm X. It's his best movie. My man Marty, he said Malcolm X, one of the top 10 movies of the 90s, wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. Denzel was nominated for Best Actor. And as Ebert said, he goes, he's carrying the torch for this film. But he had no chance of winning because Pacino had never won. So Pacino had to win for Scent of a Woman, even though Denzel and Malcolm X, it is one of the great big screen epics of all time. You know, my criticism earlier of Sully, just what a bland central character he was. Well, Malcolm X was a riveting character. You know, Malcolm Little, as a kid, was a hustler. He was a pimp. He was an absolute criminal. He goes to prison. He then converts to Islam. He meets this character, Baines, who helps him see the light. He educates himself. He becomes a member of the very radical, very militant Nation of Islam, which is preaching separation between blacks and whites. So he rises to prominence through that. That's the second act. And then the third act is he actually kind of has a crisis of conscience because he realizes that Elijah Muhammad is not who he once was, or not who at least he believed him to be. He ends up leaving the Nation of Islam, tries to go towards a more mainstream element of his faith, and then ends up being assassinated by the very people with whom he was working for. It's Spike Lee's, you know, powerful epic. I'd say it's his best movie, along with Do the Right Thing. But for Denzel, what he did in Malcolm X, I mean, you watch that movie and you go, this guy's one of the all-time greats. The way he's able to show compassion, he's able to show charm, he's able to show leadership. Like, you watch that movie and you go back and watch old school, like, real footage of Malcolm X, and it's indistinguishable. Like, Denzel looks eerily like him, especially those speeches. Like, his oratorical skills are incredible. So Malcolm X is one of the greats. So my top five Denzel Washington movies are Malcolm X, Glory, Courage Under Fire, Inside Man, and The Hurricane. Now Stanzik is going to be upset as to why I did not include Deja Vu. Or Crimson Tide.
I actually like Deja Vu. You also, hang on, you didn't have Training Day in there.
Training Day did not make it.
Denzel won the Academy Award. He was the second African-American ever to win the Academy Award, and he won it for that role. Ethan Hawke.
I love Ethan Hawke.
Terrible guy. And you're a hater again. What's wrong with... Training Day.
The opening is great. I love the whole refrain of my man and the way he comes across as this big, larger-than-life gangster. Like, it's Denzel's Scarface, which is a good thing, but I think the third act is too over the top, and the King Kong ain't got nothing on me. Like, it's entertaining, but I thought it was grandstanding at that point.
You love those lines in, like, Breaking Bad. You're all about those villains.
I am the danger.
But yeah, that's what I'm saying. So you love him there. You hate him in Training Day. You're inconsistent.
Can Training Day honorable mention. I don't think it's a great – listen, he's great, and it's entertaining. He shouldn't have won an Oscar for it. He should have won an Oscar for these other movies. Training Day is the one notable omission. Although, you're a big Pelican Brief guy.
I was going to say it if you didn't. Him and Julia Roberts. Oh, what a film. Grisham novel. Check it out. Pelican Brief.
Keep the heat coming. Adnan, ESPN, go ahead and tell me how outraged you are that I did not include Training Day or the Pelican Brief in our actor's showcase.
Remember the Titans, too.
Yeah, I'm not crazy. Right. I get it. You know, I'm not. You like
John Q?
John Q. Awful. When people try to go, how great is John Q? I'm like, are you kidding? If I thought Forrest Gump was shameless and manipulative, what do you think I think John Q is? What a turkey that movie was.
Streaming suggestions.
We got a ton here. Stanzik loaded me up, so we'll try to go, as he's emailed me, be judicious. The best advice he's given in a while. Netflix Jaws. This is coming hot off the heels of the fact the AFI, the American Film Institute tribute, was to John Williams. Many people is the greatest composer of all time. Here's a stat for you. John Williams has been nominated for an Oscar 50 times. Like, I love Ennio Morricone. You know, he did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He did The Hateful Eight, the Tarantino film, which he finally won an Oscar for. He had never won an Oscar previously. I love James Horner. He did the Glory soundtrack. He did Titanic. But really, I don't know how you can get a better composer. Well, you know what? Bernard Herrmann was Hitchcock's guy. He's outstanding. I should rephrase. I'd put Bernard Herrmann right there and then John Williams. But five Oscars and 50 nominations. And one of his best scores, like when you go through it, you go, hey, this is Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Schindler's List is a great soundtrack because it's so moving and melancholy with those violins. But of course, Star Wars he'll never top. I think Raiders of the Lost Ark is a very good one. Superman he did the score for. But Jaws is a great one. And he explained the story when I watched the AFI tribute, which was aired last week on Turner Classic Movies. He said just that whole idea of going dun-dun-dun. He said he was fiddling around on his piano. He's actually, his parents worked in the film industry, and they were into music. So as a kid, he was really, you know, he became this virtuoso. But he was just playing around. And Spielberg goes, what kind of music can we have when the shark comes? And he goes, I just thought those beats, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and we'll just speed it up the closer the camera gets to the shark. And it was so deceptively simplistic, but it was amazing. And they tell the story. They go, when people watch Jaws, they just heard that music and they go, I can't take it. Like, it was so intense. It's just dun-dun-dun, and the camera would start moving in. You haven't even seen a bloody shark. It's just a bunch of kids playing in the water, but it was so powerful. And I get it. Like, watching it again, you go, that music was amazing. So if for some reason you've never seen Jaws, see it for the John Williams music alone, along with, of course, Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, and Spielberg's first masterpiece. It was amazing what he did back in 1975, considering he couldn't get a shark that looked realistic, wildly over budget. The stories behind Jaws are amazing, but the movie itself still holds up. And Man on Wire, which is a great documentary, this was about Philippe Petit, who was a high walker who crossed the Twin Towers. And this movie came out in 2008 and won the Oscar for documentary. It is such an uplifting film, like not to be fanciful about it, but it's one of those movies that makes you believe in the human spirit. It really does. Like, this guy was so inspired by the Twin Towers and what he could accomplish that in the middle of the night, they have this crazy raid that was done, you know, obviously under the radar because it was so illegal. And he just puts this balance beam and he literally crossed between it. It was like he was walking on air. And I was not alive for that episode itself. So to see it, it really comes thrillingly to life. They have Petit talking about it along with his accomplices. Along with the police, how they reacted when they just looked up and, oh my God, there's this man in the sky who's walking back and forth. Man on Wire, a great documentary. That's currently on Netflix. Amazon Prime, Any Given Sunday, of course, it's my man Pacino. Really good football movie. The inch-by-inch speech alone is amazing. Pacino, when I went and saw him a couple months ago, he goes, people still come up to you. He goes, apparently athletes tell me all the time. They say, we watch that speech all the time. We put it in the locker room. It inspires us. And Al was like, great. Oliver Stone said, he goes, when I knew I had Al, I said, I have to have at least one scene where he gives the big coach's speech. And for a genre which is often cliched and very predictable and hackneyed like sports movies, Any Given Sunday, I still think it's a really good sports movie. I think it has great action, good violence. I like the scenes between Pacino and Fox. And, of course, they have that great speech scene at the end. Also, I'm recommending Full Metal Jacket. Speaking of speeches, R. Lee Ermey, who plays the sergeant in Full Metal Jacket, if you want a good laugh, and maybe you have to be a little deranged like me and Stanzer, but like the first 10 minutes is the way he just belittles these guys. Okay, I do have a sick sense of humor because he's absolutely just crazy. The insults that he throws at these people, Vincent D'Onofrio eventually crumbling under the weight of it. But when I saw J.K. Simmons in Whiplash, I was like, oh, he's doing what Arlie Ermey did in Full Metal Jacket, which is just dehumanize all these souls around you. Kubrick's film, I think the first hour is brilliant. I think the second hour really falls off, and it's terrible. Whenever people go, what are some great war movies? I saw Platoon, Apocalypse Now, Glory, and the first hour of Full Metal Jacket. Like, what about the second hour? They go, it stinks. Like, as soon as Arlie Ermey goes away, the movie completely fizzles for me. On Hulu, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Let's get a little comedy in there. Can I relieve myself? Yes. Thank you. Steve Martin, great scene with Michael Caine. Michael Caine. Stanzik knows. I only did this just so I could do a Michael Caine impression. If you want to talk like Michael Caine, you must only say a few words at a time. Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s. Now he talks very, very slowly. And he gets a shaky voice. Master Wayne. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is when he had made the transition from old Michael Caine to new Michael Caine, but not quite the shaky voice. Also recommending 8 Men Out. It's my favorite baseball movie. John Sayles, John Cusack is in the cast. David Strathairn playing Eddie Seacott. Charlie Sheen's in the movie. John Mahoney plays the manager. Great movie, because it's, you know, like all great sports films, it's not only about the sport, but what went on behind it. And it's all about the Black Sox scandal and how it really kind of ripped America from its innocence of that time. But you feel sympathy for these guys. Comiskey was a cheap guy. Their owner was screwing them. So, yeah, let's go ahead and throw the World Series, as crazy as that sounds. Eight Men Out is still a great, great movie. HBO Now, a couple movies for you. Rushmore, which earlier discussed. You don't need to go over that again. Stanzik agrees it's a great movie. He just doesn't think the Bill Murray role is the top five. But I would quibble with that. I think Bill Murray's...
You had it at number one.
No, I didn't.
Yes,
did I?
You did. It was your number one Bill Murray movie. Number one role.
It's because I keep screwing up the rules that you have laid correctly, which is you should rank the role, not the movie. I just love Rushmore as a movie so much, I keep superseding that.
Right? Groundhog Day is the answer, but continue.
Groundhog Day, I was up there, right? I had it two or three. It was definitely,
two or three.
Groundhog Day may be actually the right answer. And also Steve Jobs. I want to know if Stanzik has seen this yet. Have you seen Steve Jobs?
No. I feel like there's been a few of them.
Yeah, you're right. The Ashton Kutcher one I'm not referring to. I'm referring to the one that Aaron Sorkin wrote. He won a Golden Globe for best screenplay.
I read the Walter Isaacson book.
And? Amazing, right?
It's very good. Yeah, it's very long, but very good.
He is not a likable individual. And that's what Steve Jobs did a good job of doing, the movie portraying the facets of him. Michael Fassbender stars in it, directed by Danny Boyle. It was a huge box office bomb. Like, nobody went and saw this movie. The critics liked it, but it's still not even enough. Like, it didn't get enough buzz at the Oscars. But I've got to be one of the few out there who really likes Steve Jobs. Check it out on HBO Now. Also, The English Patient, which you talk about great Oscar miscarriages of justice. This one doesn't get enough play. People always mention when Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan, which is awful. I have obviously gone on a tirade about Forrest Gump beating Shawshank and Pulp Fiction. I would add to that, Goodfellas Dances with Wolves is embarrassing. And 1980... Ordinary People is still a good movie. Robert Redford directed it, but shouldn't it beat Raging Bull, which is one of the all-time great movies. But among that list, 96, English Patient won Best Picture over Fargo. Like, are you kidding me? Who in the last 20 years has said, I feel like watching The English Patient tonight versus let's watch Fargo? How funny is that movie? So that's another one to throw out there. The English Patient is streaming on HBO Now.
Actors in three words.
All right, I always screw this up because I never shut up. So this time I'm going to do it properly, which is Stanzik says the actor, and then I say it. We took a respite from three words, right? We didn't do it last time.
Well, we had De Niro, and he did three words on Scorsese, so we felt like it was done properly.
Do you think it's good that he did it, even though he didn't do it the right way?
Well, you can do it either way. It's fine, but I think we enjoy the when there's three different words.
Correct.
Instead of a continuous three words.
But you're right. You can do it either way.
But we're trying to get new listeners, new subscribers, so we're trying to bring in our guy Brooksy here. So our first actor in three words is Will Smith.
Brooksy just obsessed with Will Smith. We'll have to do an actor showcase of Will Smith soon for Brooksy. First one is Fresh Prince, because that's all I think about is the Fresh Prince. The next one is Stud. Like, his movies, as far as making money, like, stud. Like, you go back at the box office grosses of Will Smith, with the exception of Concussion, which was a real dud coming out at Christmas, this real downer of a movie. Generally, you get Will Smith in a movie, you're going to make a ton of money. So if you're a studio, you look at him, you think stud. And the third word for him is West Philadelphia, because I just always think of the song. So Will Smith's life in three words, I've done two from The Fresh Prince. In West Philadelphia. Feel free to change West Philadelphia for something else.
Let's just move on.
Let's go with his kid. I think of his child, the fact he's trying to emulate his father. How about do that?
The new Karate Kid?
Yeah, the new Karate Kid.
Okay.
Yeah, so the three words for Will Smith are Fresh Prince, Stud, and Karate Kid.
Excellent. Yep. Cameron Diaz. So you talked Any Given Sunday earlier.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to go Goofy, which I like about her. Like, you think of Charlie's Angels, she's shaking her butt around everything. You think of her in The Mask. You know, she's always being silly. I like that about her. You see her on talk shows. She doesn't look like she takes herself too seriously. She does not have any pretension about her. So I think she's goofy in a good way. I think she's flirtatious. Again, you always see her in these movies, always kind of ramping up her sex appeal. But I also think, and this is the third word, is drama, meaning she could use one. Like, it's always these comedies. I'd like to see her do something beyond just playing this goofy, flirtatious hot chick, because, not to be mean, she's getting a little advanced here in age now. So when you're, you know, hitting 50, you can't just keep doing sex tape with all these people.
Have you seen the movie What Happens in Vegas with her and Ashton Kutcher?
I have not.
You're missing out.
Really? Really funny? Really
very funny.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, keep the bar low.
No, that's fine. Listen, I recommend
you watch it. You watch terrible movies all the time.
I'm about to say, so. I recommend a Dirty Rotten Scoundrel, so we can watch a stupid comedy once in a while.
All right, a guy that does comedy and drama pretty well, Jonah Hill.
First one, you know what it's going to be, Rotund. Right out of the gate. You think of Jonah Hill, like, that guy is rotund.
But he's the guy that went to Hollywood and lost some weight.
Right, he was fat, achieved fame, went skinny, and then his agent was like, no, you're better when you're fat. Like, you're not going to get the roles you want.
So he's Oprah.
That's the second word then. You know what? I'm going to go ahead. Oprah. So first one is rotund. Second word is Oprah. Third word is Marty, because every interview he does, he may love – well, he doesn't as much as me, but he may love Scorsese as much as me, because every interview he always talks about Marty. He's like, you know what? I don't care what happens in my life. Scorsese loves me. He's like, he cast me in Wolf of Wall Street. The story he tells, Leo got like $10-15 million, whatever it was for it, and Jonah Hill got paid scale. He was on Howard Stern. And he was like – and Howard Stern was blown away. He goes, hang on a second. Scorsese calls you and goes, you got the movie, you got paid scale? He's like, yeah. He goes, give me the amount. And Jonah's like, well, I can't. He goes, give me the amount. He goes, I don't know. It was like $75,000. He goes, hang on a second. You got paid $75,000 to Wolf of Wall Street and DiCaprio made $20 million. Are you kidding? And Jonah Hill's reasoning was great. He goes, listen, I'll make my money on all those other movies that I make, like all those big, goofy comedies and the stuff, you know, like This Is the End with Franco and those guys, or 22 Jump Street. He goes, I'll do that stuff with Channing Tatum. That's where I make my money. He goes, I just want to work with Marty. He goes, you understand, like, I'm obsessed with Scorsese. I'll do whatever he says. Like, I auditioned for it. I sent him tapes. Like, when I did it, I had the fake teeth in, so I looked like Donnie Azoff. He's like, I would have done, like, cocaine on set if Scorsese's like, yeah, we really want you to get into character. I'm like, fine, I'll get coked up. That's what you want me to do. So I love the fact Jonah Hill loves Marty.
Wait, they weren't doing coke?
The powder they were doing, apparently, I can't remember what it was, whatever the replica for cocaine, still does cause issues. Because they said at times we had nosebleeds, and people are like, hang on a second, are you guys actually on coke? They're like, no, no, it's this baby powder. Like, yeah, yeah, sure. The baby powder that Scorsese gives you guys. Sure, whatever. So three words, rotund, Oprah, and Marty.
The Oprah one needs some explaining. Drew Barrymore.
E.T., first thing I think of. You know, you think of kid stars in great movies. Drew Barrymore is one of those, so E.T. made her name. Cute is the second word. It's just that puckish look on her. Let's go with puckish. Puckish is the second word for Drew Barrymore. Rather than cute, we'll go E.T. and puckish. The third one, limited. Like, what do you expect of Drew Barrymore beyond E.T. and maybe a romantic comedy?
I think she's terrible. I have a strong dislike for Drew Barrymore. Like, I've never gotten it. I've never thought she was particularly good at anything.
I think that's a reasonable criticism. Like, aside from E.T., and like I said, a couple of rom-coms, which a lot of actresses could do, I don't think what she's doing is anything special.
So she was in The Wedding Singer. Great. Got it. Okay.
I love it.
She was Carrie in Charlie's Angels. Okay.
Right. Let's cross
Drew
Barrymore.
She's just well-connected and knows people and was a child star and people know her name. She has name recognition.
I would agree with you on that.
All right. Lastly, Edward Norton.
I think he's underutilized. How great is he in Birdman? Like, I think Keaton should have won the Oscar, but Edward Norton is fantastic in Birdman. Like, you look at his movies, you know, starting with Primal Fear, made him a star back in 96, put him on the map. But 25th Hour, he's excellent in with Spike Lee, directed that. The monologue he gives about how much anger he has towards New York and the ending to that movie is really powerful still. Ed Norton, I think, is underutilized. I think he's crafty, which I think is interesting in his movies. He always has this intelligence about him, whether it's Rounders or whether it's Birdman. His character is always kind of crafty and kind of smart. And the third word for him, I don't really have one, to be honest with you, Stanzik. Ed Norton, I think, underutilized, crafty. There's not a third one that jumps out.
Fight Club.
All right, we'll go with Fight Club.
Tyler Durden.
Okay, Durden. The three words are under...
Soap.
Just soap. The three words are underutilized, crafty, and soap. The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
A Scorsese story.
There is a generous soul walking this earth who does not want acclaim or recognition. Whoever sent me this book, please tell me so I can thank you. Is it the publisher? Is it the author? In case you're new to the podcast, somebody sent me this gorgeous coffee table Martin Scorsese book, a retrospective. It's 276 pages. I finally finished the Jim Miller book, the CA book, 707 pages. How far into that are you, Stanzik?
I think about 230. I don't think I've picked it up in a week and a half. It's a struggle.
Because you've inspired me. I said, I want to be like you in that you read a book every 2 weeks. So I started the Jim Miller book like late August. I'm like, I got to be done by September 15th. So I pounded through. But it is an exhaustive chronicle of what agency and the rise to stardom. So now I'm crushing the Marty book. I'm 90 pages in. It's great because it goes movie by movie, and it's a combination of these gorgeous photographs. You know, it's a big coffee table book. It's like, you know, pictures of him and De Niro behind the scenes and the rest of the cast. And then it's like a kind of a critical appreciation of each movie and then maybe a couple of stories about it. So I was reading this stuff about Mean Streets yesterday, and it was great, you know, telling how shoestring budget, and his dad actually raised some of the money asking some locals in the neighborhood. And people in the neighborhood actually were a little bit annoyed. They were like, what kind of depiction are you doing of Little Italy and of us? Like, we're a bunch of crooks and gamblers. And Marty's like, well, that's kind of what I saw like growing up here when I looked outside my tenement building. That's what it was. And the review from Pauline Kael, I remember I reread it last night. It said it's a personal triumph of filmmaking, and that's why the critics all loved it, because they were like, this clearly is coming from this guy's soul. Like, it's such a semi-autobiographical story. It's clearly done with his heart and a lot of passion. And the way that it was influenced by European filmmakers, all those jump cuts, the use of the music. Like they said, even the first 5 minutes, you could tell watching that in the theater in 1973, this is the birth of a new filmmaker. And a lot of people confuse it with Scorsese's first movie. He made Who's That Knocking at My Door, which he's only partly happy with because it was such a struggle to make. And it was off and on for like 4 years. Keitel was the star of that movie as well. But even when he looks back at it, he's like, well, it had some flaws. Even though Ebert liked it, the Chicago Film Festival, he said, watch out for this guy. Then he did Boxcar Bertha, which he actually had a budget and worked with Roger Corman and learned how to make movies on the fly. But when John Cassavetes, who was one of his heroes, saw it, he goes, Marty, you just wasted a year of your life. Like, it's well-crafted, but it's a piece of crap. Go do something with your heart. That's what inspired Mean Streets, which the original script for it was called Season of the Witch. And his buddy Jay Cox, who was a film critic with Time Magazine, suggested the title. And Marty actually goes, Mean Streets sounds kind of pretentious. Like, where are you getting that from? And Jay Cox said, it's from a Raymond Chandler novel. It's a line, down the mean streets a man must go. And Marty's like, yeah, okay, I guess it's kind of about adolescence and these guys kind of rising up. Season of the Witch would have been a terrible title.
Hang on. I feel like the term mean streets is kind of a colloquialism now.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm from the mean streets of Philly or
correct.
Something. Is this all from that movie?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was all spawned originally from the Raymond Chandler novel, who is known for writing these hard-boiled crime fiction stories.
I didn't expect to learn this much today.
Yes.
Just one quick question on the film, because I've seen it.
Yeah,
now.
This, by the way, this Scorsese story is about Stanza, because you finally saw Mean Streets.
I saw the film, and we talked about it briefly. You said it's like the way he shot it was so much different than anything.
Right.
Because to me, I didn't notice it as being this like landmark film.
Right.
But like the camera's moving all over the place, the music, I get it. I guess that wasn't happening before.
Correct.
But my question, did Harvey Keitel and De Niro sleep in the same bed together?
They mentioned that in this coffee table book I'm reading. It said something about there's all these little touches that Marty put from his friends. The way that they'll grab trash can lids and fight with them until 6 in the morning and then share a bed together. And they quoted the one line. He goes, hey, do you want me to tuck you in, sweetie? I don't know if De Niro says it to Keitel. Keitel says to him. That was Stanza. Those are his two biggest takeaways from Mean Streets.
Because you never see them actually in the same bed together, but one of them's still in the bed, and like you can kind of see an imprint, and they're making the joke. I'm pretty sure they did.
The homoeroticism.
There's anything
of mean
wrong
streets.
With that?
No, there's nothing wrong. Of course not. But it is not something you're expecting in this masculine film and this movie about the mean streets. Like, oh, how about the scene where Keitel and De Niro share a bed? Okay. Yeah, if you go back, like, I'm glad Stanzik is now scenic. It's just important for film education. I know what you mean. Like, sometimes you see a movie and you go, I guess it was important for its time. Now I see so many movies do that, so I guess that it's been often imitated, never duplicated, but it doesn't, you know, resonate for me. But yeah, that first few minutes just of, that's actually Scorsese's voiceover. He says, you don't make up for your sins in the church, you do in the street, the rest is BS and you know it. And you just cut to Keitel, Sleepless Night goes back. The way he jump cuts, those three cuts, the Ronettes, Be My Baby. Like, at the time it was like, you never used pop music. You always used classical scores like Bernard Herrmann or, you know, later John Williams, the way Spielberg would. So at that time it was like, oh, he's using the music that you'd hear coming out of the jukebox in the 50s and 60s and that montage of seeing him Little Italy. And also that pool hall sequence, that was big because they were like, the way that this fight starts with the guy calling him a mook. He's like, a mook, what's a mook? And this guy's bam! And then the camera just follows him running all over the pool hall while they're playing Mr. Postman's the song. Like, De Niro's just wielding this pool cue, like, on top of the table, ready to fight anybody. And then the cops come, like, oh, this is a big misunderstanding. The cops, they fight again. The other crazy thing about Mean Streets, for such a quintessential New York movie, 90% of it shot in Los Angeles. It was shot in 27 days, maybe 21 days, and the vast majority was in L.A., and then they had like 3 or 4 days to go shoot exterior. So one scene, since Stanzik has seen it, it's fresh, De Niro and Keitel are on top of the rooftop, and he's shooting a gun. And Marty was like, hey, make sure you do this properly because, you know, you're actually – I guess the interior was in L.A., then the exterior was in New York, so it was very tricky in terms of, okay, shoot in this direction or shoot this way because it feels like a New York movie. Like, everything about it is, and yet all the interiors were shot in Los Angeles.
Isn't that the same in Seinfeld, shot in L.A. but based in New York?
Yeah, which is crazy. When you go back, there's a Seinfeld comedians in cars getting coffee with Gary Shandling where they walk by that old lot. And he was like, oh, yeah, this is where we had Seinfeld. When you actually see the show, you go, really? None of that was in New York City? I'm like, no, it was all in a lot. That whole street, the whole apartment building, like, it feels so much like New York. So, magic of filmmaking. So, I'm just pumped. My boy Stanzik's seen The Verdict. He's seen Mean Streets. King of Comedy's up next. He doesn't have a Blu-ray player. So somebody out there who is so generous who sent me this book, can you send in a Blu-ray player, care of ESPN, hook my buddy Stanzik up? up? Because I really want him to watch The King of Comedy. I know he was a little bit underwhelmed by Main Street, but I think he'll love The King of Comedy. I just recommended it to another guy, Mark Simon, here, and he thought he was dead. That was a really funny movie. I enjoyed it. I'm glad you recommended it. So Blu-ray player hopefully forthcoming. I'm Adam Amberg. Thanks for downloading Cinephile, and I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.